Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Solyndra scandal is the kind of story tailor-made for Fox News. A green jobs-creating solar power company receiving millions of dollars of taxpayer funds celebrated by the Obama White House goes belly up. Much of the coverage all but shouts scandal. It's not that there's nothing here, but the story we're hearing about Solyndra might not be the one we should be hearing. Journalist and activist Harvey Wasserman will join us to talk about that. Also on Counterspin today, sponsored by the same foundations and corporate interests behind what's called education reform, NBC's recent Education Nation Summit was unlikely to stretch the boundaries of corporate media debate. FAIR hosted our own conversation recently in New York City with education experts and activists with a critical take on big media's storyline, not to mention the political narrative it echoes. We'll hear from two participants, education historian Diane Ravitch and teacher activist Brian Jones. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
It took a while, but corporate media are giving serious coverage to the Occupy Wall Street protests. But new CNN host Aaron Burnett thought what the protests really needed was a fact check. On October 3rd, Burnett explained that the protesters didn't know what they were protesting, a point reinforced by her guest, former Rudy Giuliani speechwriter John Avlon. Burnett, who worked on Wall Street and is engaged to a Citigroup executive, then went down to the protests herself to explain to them how the world really works. She informed one protester that, quote, taxpayers actually made money on the Wall Street bailout, close quote. This fact should put an end to all the unrest. Quote, this was the big issue, so we solved it, close quote. But the TARP bailouts aren't the central motivator behind the protests, and even if they were, Burnett's understanding of how they worked is flawed. That TARP money amounted to low-interest loans for banks that had profited handsomely from, among other things, a massive housing bubble. Some of those banks, like Burnett's former employer Goldman Sachs, turned around and used that money to make more money, promptly paying off the government loan. It's hard to see this as a win for taxpayers. And, as many critics have pointed out, the government got burned on those loans by charging too little. And remember, TARP loans are a tiny part of the total government bailout of the financial sector, which runs in the trillions of dollars. Most Americans didn't get low-interest emergency assistance, which is actually one of the reasons people are protesting Wall Street. To Aaron Burnett, the fact that banks were rescued shows there's no reason to protest. I know it doesn't make any sense, but remember, it's the weirdos with the bongo drums who don't know the facts.
What does it take to get a New York Times business writer to check out Occupy Wall Street? And that's not really a riddle, but it was answered by the Times' Andrew Ross Sorkin on October 4th. Sorkin's write-up isn't bad overall and includes a decent description of protesters' message as being about seeking accountability for Wall Street and corporate America for the financial crisis and the growing economic inequality gap. But Sorkin's been criticized for being a little too chummy with his Wall Street sources, and his setup to this piece won't dispel that. He writes, quote, I had gone down to Zuccotti Park to see the activist movement firsthand after getting a call from the chief executive of a major bank last week, before nearly 700 people were arrested over the weekend during a demonstration on the Brooklyn Bridge. Is this Occupy Wall Street thing a big deal? The CEO asked me. I didn't have an answer. We're trying to figure out how much we should be worried about all this, he continued, clearly concerned. Is this going to turn into a personal safety problem? Close quote. Well, points to Sorkin for honesty, I guess. But readers can also hope that he would take a personal interest in events on his beat, even absent a phone call from a worried banker.
To the chagrin of many in the corporate media, New Jersey Republican Governor Chris Christie will not run for president after all. The wild speculation about Christie among GOP insiders was matched, if not exceeded, by the Beltway media. ABC reporter Jonathan Carl called a Christie speech in California, quote, the most electrifying event of the campaign so far, close quote. The real issue here was the media's refusal to take no for an answer. Christie had repeatedly and rather vehemently said he wasn't going to run for president. But the media didn't want to hear that, and they went out of their way to hear something else. Take the September 28th NBC Nightly News. After airing a clip of Christie saying he wasn't going to run, reporter Chuck Todd tries his best to find another meaning.
But when an audience member pleaded with him,
"I mean this with all my heart. We can't wait another 4 years to 2016. We need you. Your country needs you to run for president."
Christie stopped joking and left an opening.
"I thank you for what you're saying, and I take it in, and I'm listening to every word of it and feeling it, too."
Everything about Christie's speech screamed national campaign.
Yes, everything except the part where he's actually running for president. The day before Christie's official "I am not a candidate" announcement, Todd reported on the NBC Nightly News that a routine event inspecting the New Jersey National Guard was actually a, quote, "presidential-looking ceremonial event," close quote. Only in his dreams.
Well, the other question to ask about the Chris Christie media obsession is why? As in, why did so many pundits and reporters want him to run for president? New York Times columnist Tom Friedman gave one answer in his October 5th column. Christie would have moved the entire political debate to the right. Friedman complains that Obama has veered too far to the left, particularly on economic issues, and that means the presidential race is shaping up to be a contest between what he calls the Democratic left and the Republican right. Christie, you see, quote, "would have forced Obama back to the center," close quote. Well, this argument has a couple of obvious flaws. For starters, it's hard to see what exactly constitutes Obama's shift to the left. For Friedman, it's apparently the rejection of cuts to safety net programs like Social Security and Medicare. On the latter, Friedman seems unaware that there are cuts to Medicare as part of the health care law, and that Obama's budget plan, the one Friedman's deriding as not touching Medicare, includes about $300 billion in cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. That's news that was reported in his own paper. Or maybe Tom Friedman does know all of this and merely thinks there should be more cutting. To him, that's centrism. The country doesn't think so. Poll after poll shows little enthusiasm for Social Security or Medicare cuts. For Friedman, and a lot of others in the media, centrism seems to mean something like common sense, which seems to mean something like things I support.
And finally, in the "When Will They Learn" department, incoming National Public Radio President Gary Nell seems to suffer from the same misunderstanding that has plagued public broadcasting executives for years. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik reports that Nell says he hopes to calm the waters a bit at NPR after recent political controversies and to depoliticize debate over the future of public radio. Nell is quoted saying, quote, "It's not about liberal or conservative. It's about fairness. We've got to make the case we're delivering a fair service," close quote. It's as if he doesn't see the road behind him strewn with various efforts to depoliticize the public broadcasting debate, which is code for appeasing its conservative enemies by adding more right-wing content and censoring things they might not like. But guess what? Politicians are political, and many of them want there to be no more publicly funded anything, but certainly not broadcasting, which they demonstrate by voting to zero out its resources every chance they get, no matter how calm the waters are. Maybe new NPR heads think they have to say such things, but to the extent that they don't sound empty, they're downright discouraging.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin's brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
The Solyndra scandal sounds like the kind of thing that Fox News Channel might have invented. A solar company cheered publicly by the Obama administration goes belly up, costing taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. One backer of the company is a foundation linked to an Obama donor. Green jobs? The government can't create those. Solar power? It's a costly pipe dream. And on and on. Now, it's not that there's nothing to this story. Clearly, there's something here. But are media pointing at the right issues? And what are they missing? Harvey Wasserman has written about renewable energy for years. His most recent book is Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth. Harvey Wasserman, welcome back to Counterspin.
Great to be with you again.
Now, when I heard about the problems with Solyndra, that it was this massive loan guarantee, I immediately thought of nuclear plants. We'll get to that in a minute, but first let's start with this company. Much of the early chatter was about a political scandal. The administration was doing a favor for a well-connected donor. That doesn't seem to really go anywhere, but it's not as if there's nothing curious or scandalous about what happened with Solyndra. What can you tell about this company's failure?
Well, first of all, the initial loan came from the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. This is not an Obama deal, although they were looking apparently at a second loan. It's very simple. What happened to Solyndra? Obviously, there were problems with the company, but the bottom line is they were undersold. They've been, when they first started, they were competitive with the Chinese, and the Chinese have since poured, by some reports, I'm sure we don't know exactly, about $30 billion into their solar production facilities. The government has. And so, you know, this the Solyndra loan was down about $500 million. And the Chinese, I'm sure many of the Chinese loans have failed too, but, you know, they're committed and they have dominated. Now they dominate, the Chinese do, the production of both wind and solar, and so and solar panels. And so Solyndra, halfway down the road, found themselves being undersold 30 to 40% by the Chinese. And what can you do, you know? And this is classic monopoly capitalism being practiced by the Chinese. They're doing pretty much what Morgan and Rockefeller and Armour and Swift, all the American robber barons did at the end of the 1800s. They just dominate production, get a monopoly, drive everybody else out of business, and then raise prices. Now, we hope that the Chinese aren't going to be able to pull that off, but Solyndra is really a casualty, not of the American loan guarantee program, but of the Chinese government subsidies to the solar industry.
It almost sounds like the problem here is that the United States government wasn't subsidizing the renewable industries enough.
Or early enough. I mean, we had the lead. We had 90% of the world's solar generating facilities. The first photovoltaic cell was manufactured at the Bell Labs in 1953. The second one went up on the Vanguard satellite. And we've had this technology for 50 years and not put the government money behind it. And all of a sudden, the Chinese have eaten our lunch and our dinner, and, you know, and our solar industry.
I was looking at, the Washington Post has been very aggressive about this story, and a piece a week and a half ago had this table of loan guarantees to various energy companies. Solyndra's ninth on this list of about, I think, 26 companies. Down at the bottom on a separate list, almost an asterisk next to it, are a couple of nuclear companies. Georgia Power is one. They've got an $8 billion loan guarantee. The lesson we're supposed to be drawing from Solyndra is that the government can't pick and choose the winners. You got to let the private sector do that. If that's the lesson, what does that tell us about nuclear power?
It tells us nuclear power is dead. I mean, there's people lining up still to invest in solar and wind and geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels if they're sustainable. I mean, you know, there's no shortage of capital for renewable, but nobody wants to invest in a nuclear plant. So we're talking about $500 million here with Solyndra. It's $8.33 billion for the Vogtle plant, two reactors in Georgia. And they're already forcing rate hikes and all sorts of economic boondoggles to keep that ridiculous nuclear project going. And, you know, the odds on a nuclear project failing, a nuclear reactor project, are at least 50%. There are quite a few studies on the history and the prospects for nuclear power loan guarantees, and it's a bad scene. And, you know, if they want to look for a scandal for Obama, it's Vogtle. It's the nuclear plant in Georgia, not Solyndra.
When the White House comes out and says most of these loan guarantees to renewable companies are working just fine, it's defensive, but is it also accurate?
Yeah. I mean, you know, solar is a growth industry, and it is the future. The renewable energy industry will be the largest industry in the history of the world. It will dwarf the internet and everything else because the entire planet has got to convert to solar, wind, tidal, all the solartopian technologies. You know, we are now in a situation where more power is being generated by renewables than by nuclear power in the United States. That landmark was turned this year, and so that's the future. And it's a multi-trillion dollar industry, and the United States is losing its lead. And we invented this stuff. I mean, we had in 1980 with Jerry Brown in the governor's mansion in California, we had 90% of the world's wind-driven electricity was produced in California. And now, you know, Germany is number one, Spain is number two, and Texas is number three. But nonetheless, you know, we've really lost the lead.
Solyndra is the poster child right now for opponents of renewable energy. They're going to want to use this company's failure to discredit the whole project. And it does seem that they have a great case study here. They can point to this, and it basically discredits every position from the White House and from the renewable side. Is there real fear among renewable energy advocates that Solyndra is the scandal that causes that sort of lives on, that has repercussions for years to come?
It could, but you know, the DOE has since granted two more loan guarantees to solar projects, and the most of them are doing not just fine, but great. Unlike nuclear, many solar projects come in ahead of schedule and under budget. If you look at the two big nuclear plants under construction in Europe right now, at Flamanville, France, and in Finland, these two projects are catastrophes financially. They're years behind, billions of dollars over budget. That doesn't usually happen with solar. Solar has a very good track record of coming in on time. And frankly, I would take a strong Republican position and say abolish all loan guarantees. Go ahead in energy, as long as you abolish the nuclear ones too, and get rid of the public insurance for nuclear reactors, you know, in the event of a major meltdown. That would be a great thing to do. Then solar will boom in this country because it's being forced to compete on an unlevel playing field against not only nuclear, but coal, oil, and gas, which are also heavily subsidized.
It sounds like the story you're telling is one where the solar industry mostly performs well, and here we have an outlier case with Solyndra, and this is the one that people are hearing all about. Is that about right?
Yeah, except you got to remember, as I said earlier, Solyndra was performing. They just got knocked out of the box by the Chinese, and so are so many other American renewable companies. And many of the stories don't mention that at all, or it's buried in the 10th paragraph. Oh, by the way, the reason Solyndra went under was they couldn't compete. It's like, you know, the local stores trying to compete with Walmart. China is becoming the Walmart of renewable energy.
We've been speaking with Harvey Wasserman. You can find out more about his most recent book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, at www.solartopia.org. Harvey Wasserman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
NBC hosted its second annual Education Nation Summit late last month, a series of events and broadcasts bankrolled by the corporate interests and foundations aligned with the so-called education reform movement. Counterspin has often talked about the corporate flavor of big media's approach to education. Stories warn of a crisis, with public school teachers isolated as the problem and private sector ideas for reform the favored response. On the heels of NBC's event, FAIR hosted Miseducation Nation here in New York City, a discussion with four thoughtful, dynamic education activists and experts who see things from a different perspective. We'll hear from two of them. Panel participant Diane Ravitch is an education historian and professor, also a former assistant secretary of education. She had just come from NBC's summit to FAIR's. Ravitch was asked about a recent article in which she questioned the very idea of a crisis in U.S. education.
What I've suggested is the crisis is the one that's been created by the so-called reform movement, that by imposing this data-driven approach to education, they have exacerbated the inequities. That if you wanted to create a system to disadvantage poor kids, base everything on testing, because there will always be a bottom half, and we know who's going to be in the bottom half. It's the kids who have the least resources, who bring the least with them. They will be the bottom half, so make everything about testing. So yes, there is a crisis. Part of what I was saying in that article is all the crisis talk right now is very cynical. And so much of the crisis talk is coming from spokesmen for Wall Street hedge fund managers, and suddenly they've gotten very, very concerned about our global competitiveness. It's as though our school children, our third graders, are causing the recession. And if only our reading scores went up, then we would have trillions more in gross economic development. And I was just thinking of something that I read from this wonderful guy who took me around in Finland. He said, you know, we need a vision, And when Dr. Martin Luther King spoke about a vision, he didn't say that our goal ought to be to increase our economic productivity by 5%. The real goal ought to be to provide a great public school, a good public school for every child in America. That would be a vision we could embrace.
That was Diane Ravitch. Panel participant Brian Jones is a public school teacher and activist and a featured voice in the film The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman. He attended NBC's Education Nation last year, but wasn't invited back. Here's Brian Jones.
I taught for 8 years in Harlem, and this year I'm teaching in downtown Brooklyn. And the difference between my former experience teaching in Harlem and where I am now is heartbreaking. It makes me want to weep that same union contract, same rules and regulations, and a totally different school from my perspective. I can't tell you how many times I've been in the middle of, let's say, a science experiment and have been told to stop what I'm doing immediately, put that down, and pick up test preparation workbooks. It's the pressure that public school educators, especially in a place like Harlem, which has more charter schools per square inch than probably anywhere on earth save New Orleans, is tremendous. And it's crushing teaching and learning. And what kills you is that I believe there's an idea that there's a kind of backward, almost like Booker T. Washington-esque idea that what little black children need is basic skills taught in isolation, and that they don't deserve the same rich, progressive curriculum that wealthier students of all races are receiving in some of our best schools in the nation. Obama sends his children to a school called the Sidwell Friends Academy. Go to their website. It's amazing what they do with kids in the early years, and they say that the curriculum is focused, again, on the humanity of the child. The first 3 years you're in that school, the number one thing they focus on is teaching you your role in the community. And so I feel that I have to, I'm really glad to be here. I was at Education Nation. I was one of the only teachers at Education Nation last year. I was on a panel with Jeffrey Canada, Michelle Rhee, and the president of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I did not expect to be invited back. And I was not invited back. A badge of honor, maybe.
You were invited here, Brian.
I'm invited here. But I feel I did go to Education Nation on Sunday to support a colleague of mine who's here who lights up a film, and I see that there's two stars of this film in the audience now, a film that people should see called American Teacher that was shown there. And I want to say something about, because some people are saying, well, there's this shift in NBC, I want to say kind of my thoughts about that. Okay, last year it was Waiting for Superman, a baseball bat to our heads. This year it's American Teacher, a film that praises teachers. A film that shows the struggles of teachers. A film that's sympathetic to teachers and shows how underpaid, how hard they work, all this kind of thing. Except that in the first few minutes of the film, you have Arne Duncan, Barack Obama, Eric Hanischek, all these kind of people saying the teacher is the most important factor inside the school. And as common sense as that sounds, I believe that the reason NBC's Education Nation seems more friendly to outside voices this year is that what they've succeeded in doing is figuring out that if they narrow the discussion, they can let anybody talk. As long as we're talking about the quality of the teacher, that means we're not talking about curriculum, we're not talking about class size, we're not talking about administration, we're not talking about poverty, we're not talking about healthcare, we're not talking about mental health, we're not talking about any of the issues that bear directly down on our classrooms as long as we're talking about teacher quality. And I believe, and look, I consider, I'm not like a great teacher, or I'm not a superhero teacher. I consider myself a good teacher. I consider myself a good teacher. But the teacher that I'm able to be in different schools is actually a very different teacher, depending on where I am and depending on the environment. I have a colleague of mine said to me, you know, if we're going to be evaluated by these test scores, then I don't want to work with special ed kids anymore. I don't want to work with severely disabled kids anymore because I know that the needle might not move for them that year. I know that what I impart to them that year might not show up on this crude, blunt instrument that they use, so-called value added. But I believe that the corporate reformers have to focus on teacher quality because it accomplishes the goal of making it seem like they care about quality while really narrowing the discussion to how to punish the labor force. I mean, frankly, look, if they want to... This is a country that literally spends tens of billions of dollars to air condition the tents of the troops in Afghanistan. And you're telling me that you can't make sure everybody has enough pencils and resources and smart boards and books and whatever else we need? So I just conclude with that. I think that it's a very convenient narrative that they're spinning at us right now. You know, it's a very convenient narrative for this economic crisis that we're in, this recession. If you want to find somebody who's really selfish, self-interested, you know, a real piece of work, it's a teacher. Just in it for themselves, can't trust them. Now look, on the other hand, you want to find an angel? You want to find somebody who's selfless, doesn't think about themselves? They're not greedy or money-grubbing. They're just in it for other people, especially the poor black and Latino children. It's the billionaires.
Bill Gates.
Those are really the best people. I mean, frankly, we need more of them in the classrooms because we can trust them, you see. I think it's a convenient narrative, and the shift we see from Education Nation 1.0 to 2.0 is more a shift in tone than it is a shift in content. Thank you.
That was teacher activist Brian Jones. Jones and Ravitch were two of the participants in FAIR's recent Miseducation Nation discussion. Listeners can see video of the whole event on the website FAIR.org. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.